Thank you so much. Hello, friends. It is an honor to be here with you in this magnificent gathering to talk about the pursuit of happiness. I want to tell you about the unusual COVID-era reading project that led me to explore what Thomas Jefferson meant when he put that famous phrase into the Declaration of Independence about the pursuit of happiness. And what I learned changed my life. It changed what I think about how to be a good person and how to be a good citizen. What I learned was that for the founders, the pursuit of happiness meant not feeling good, but being good. Not the pursuit of immediate pleasure, but the pursuit of long-term virtue. And then I want to tell you about how this new understanding has made me a missionary for studying the ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration. So here's how this COVID reading project developed. Just around when COVID started, I noticed that both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson had taken as their understanding of the pursuit of happiness from a book by Cicero I'd never heard of called The Tusculan Disputations. And first, I was reading Benjamin Franklin, and there's that part of his autobiography that some of you may have seen. In his 20s, Ben Franklin resolved to achieve moral perfection, and he made a list of 12 virtues that he later expanded to 13. And they included temperance, order, resolution, frugality, cleanliness. He saved the one he found hardest for last, and that's humility. And he made a chart, and he put the virtues on the x-axis, and he put the days of the week on the y-axis, and every day he resolved to focus on a different virtue and to put an X mark in the box where he'd fallen short. He tried this for a while. He found it was incredibly depressing because there's so many X marks, and he gave it up after a while, but he felt that he was a better person for having engaged in this serious act of self-accounting and self-reflection. So I knew about the system, which I'd seen before, but what I didn't know is he chose as his motto this Cicero book called The Tusculan Disputations, and the passage from Cicero that Franklin chose to illustrate the project was, "Without virtue, happiness cannot be." A few weeks later, I was at the Boar's Head Inn in Charlottesville, Virginia, home of UVA and the crowning achievement of Thomas Jefferson. We see the beautiful Jefferson monument behind us. And on the wall of the hotel room was a list of 12 virtues that Jefferson drafted for his daughters. And they looked a lot like Franklin's. They included virtues like resolution, resolve to do what you ought and do what you resolve, silence, when angry, count to 10, when very angry, 100. And Jefferson offered these virtues to his daughters, but what was so striking is when I learned that when Jefferson was asked to illustrate the virtues and to define happiness, he would send a passage from that same Cicero book that Franklin had used, The Tusculan Disputations. And it was a longer passage that Jefferson copied in his commonplace book when his dad died. He's 14 years old, he's trying to overcome his grief, and he copies the passage that Cicero himself has written when his daughter Tullia died, and Cicero is trying to console himself. This is from a manual on grief, and it's from that manual Jefferson takes his core definition of the pursuit of happiness, which says, "He who has achieved tranquility of soul, who is neither unduly exuberant nor unduly despondent, he is the self-composed man of whom we are in quest. He is the wise and happy man." So I thought, my goodness, this passage was so important to Franklin and Jefferson. I've got to read Cicero's Tusculan Disputations, but what else to read? Then I found this golden reading list that Jefferson would send to anyone who asked him when he was old how to be an educated person. He'd send this to kids who were going to law school. He'd send this to his friends who were trying to build private libraries. It's an incredible list, both because of the range of the books and also the rigorous schedule that Jefferson prescribes for reading them. The range is inspiring. It includes novels and political philosophy and history and science and law. What caught my eye was the section on moral philosophy. Sometimes Jefferson called it ethics and sometimes natural religion. And at the top of the list was that Cicero book, the Tusculan Disputations, and then a list of other books of classical and Enlightenment moral philosophy. Cicero's On Duties, Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, Epictetus, Seneca's Letters, and then Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, Bolingbroke, Hume. I was so struck by the fact that I had not read all of the books on this list. And I've had a marvelous liberal arts education, and I am so grateful every day to the inspiring teachers of literature. I was an English major in college, and political philosophy and history and law, who I was privileged to study with at all these wonderful universities. But I hadn't read these books of moral philosophy because they'd fallen out of the curriculum by the time that I was in college back in the 1980s. And I remember in the 80s yearning for this kind of guidance about how to lead a good life. The 1980s were the greed is good decade, and pop culture was celebrating hedonism and materialism, and I was looking for an alternative to that. I did not find it in Puritan literature, which I was studying as an English major, first of all, because I'm Jewish, and also because the Puritan prescriptions of faith purely by grace without the possibility of good works assuring salvation was not compelling to me. So I was looking for an alternative. And what I didn't realize, because these great books had fallen out of the curriculum, is this is exactly the question that the classical moral philosophers had set out to answer. The other thing that really struck me about Jefferson's list was his schedule. He said, you've got to get up every morning before dawn, read the moral philosophy for 2 hours, watch the sunrise, then read ancient history and political philosophy, then lunch, then science, astronomy, and physics, and so forth, then dinner, then you're allowed a little Shakespeare and light poetry for mild entertainment, and then to bed, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I don't know what got into me, but it was COVID, and we all have more time. So I tried the Jefferson schedule, and I got up every morning, I read the moral philosophy for 2 hours, I watched the sunrise, which is the most beautiful thing you can do any morning of the day. It is just glorious to make that a daily habit. And then I found myself writing sonnets to sum up the wisdom of the moral philosophy that I'd read, which I know sounds incredibly weird, because I had not written sonnets before. I later found out that all sorts of people in the founding era would read this moral philosophy and write sonnets, including Hamilton wrote some sonnets. The great Phyllis Wheatley, the first published black poet in America, wrote incredibly inspiring sonnets of virtue based on her reading. And then John Quincy Adams, one of my great heroes, would read the Tusculan Disputations and the Bible in the White House, watch the sunrise, write sonnets opposing slavery, and then walk along the Potomac. It's just remarkable. There's something in this wisdom that craves to be summed up in harmonious, practical form. So that's what I did, and what I learned changed my life. As I said, it was a revelation to me, and there's no other word strong enough to describe the force of the insight that for the founders and for the ancients and for people throughout human history, happiness has meant not feeling good, but being good. Not the pursuit of immediate pleasure, but the pursuit of long-term virtue. But what I came to realize by reading the wisdom literature is that by virtues, the founders and the ancients meant something in particular. They meant self-mastery, self-improvement, character improvement, being your best self, overcoming your ego-based passions and emotions so that you can serve other people and connect to the divine. It is ultimately a quest for moral perfection. And it was rooted in the classics and in the Bible. Jesus in Matthew says, be perfect. And the founders and the ancients took seriously the injunction to try in our own imperfect way to become a bit more perfect every day, and in fact, every hour, because the pursuit of virtue requires daily, hourly mindfulness to master your unreasonable passions and emotions so that you can achieve that calm tranquility and self-mastery that Cicero said defines happiness. To prepare for the honor of this talk, I asked some friends who are members of the LDS Church in what ways the church cultivates virtue. And I was so struck by how focused and how mindfully the church has been to the practical cultivation of virtue since the beginning. My friend Sheldon Gilbert, the new head of the Federalist Society, and one of my former students and a former colleague at GW Law School, called my attention to Luke. And Luke 2:52 says, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man." And Sheldon shared with me that the LDS Church views these as the four pillars of personal development: intellectual, physical, spiritual, and social, and encourages youth to think about what you're doing every day to improve intellectually, physically, spiritually, and socially. And then I just had the most wonderful conversation before the talk with Vice President Collings, who has a really important new book on divine law that explores so thoughtfully the way that scripture enjoins study of the Constitution and the virtues. And Vice President Collings called my attention to the passage, "According to the laws and constitution of the people, which I have suffered to be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles, that every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity, according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment." And I've learned how central the idea of moral agency and accountability is to the church, and was really inspired to learn about Section 4 of the Doctrine of Covenant, which I know you all know, and I'm told that if I ask you to stand and recite it, you can. So please give me the honor of doing that. Would you please stand and recite Section 4 of the Doctrine of Covenant?
I'll get you started. "Now behold, a marvelous work
is about to come forth among the children of men. Therefore, believe in the hearts and service of God, see that you serve him with all your heart and mind, and strength, and in his hand wages before God the last day. Therefore, if he has desires to serve God, you are called to the work. For behold, the field is ripe already to harvest, and lo, you have rested in the sickle of the vine.
Amen. Beautiful, beautiful. So meaningful. Thank you so much for that. Friends, you are uniquely well prepared for the daily cultivation of virtue because you live it, and you know the importance of attempting in your daily life, in a really practical way, of living up to those virtues that you just recited, including temperance and prudence and the rest. And you know, both from the spiritual self-accounting system that the church has offered to see how you're doing every day, which is, of course, a version of Ben Franklin's system, that it really is it's a daily and an hourly quest. And we all fall short because nobody is perfect, except Franklin said, "Imitate Jesus and Socrates in your attempt to be perfect." Well, we can try. We're not going to achieve it, but we can become more perfect in trying. Another thing that I learned from my reading is that this quest to become more perfect through the daily cultivation of virtue is common to all of the wisdom traditions. And for the classical people, it goes back to Pythagoras. Who knew? I didn't. That Pythagoras, in addition to inventing the triangle and the harmonic system, If that weren't enough, he also was the philosopher who identified a fundamental struggle in our souls between reason, passion, and desire. And he located reason in the head and passion or emotion in the heart and desire in the stomach, and said we have a duty every day to use our powers of reason to moderate or modulate our unreasonable passions and emotions so we can achieve the calm, tranquility, and self-mastery that defines virtue, excellence, and perfection of the soul. And Plato popularized Pythagoras's division of the soul with his metaphor of the charioteer representing reason, who had two horses. One was noble and the other was appetitive. And the goal of the charioteer is to ensure that all of the two horses are pulling in the same direction. And that antithesis between reason and passion is ubiquitous throughout the founding. You see it both in the moral literature and in the political literature, and that's why James Madison defines a faction as any group, a majority or a minority, animated by passion rather than reason, devoted to self-interest rather than the public good. And now you see, and I did, with new clarity, the central connection the founders offered between personal and political self-government. Unless I, as an individual, can overcome my unproductive passions and emotions like anger, jealousy, and fear, get out of my own head and start focusing on others, then I won't be able to join with my fellow citizens to keep the republic as part of a virtuous state. And that's why the founders are not sure that the experiment will succeed, because it all requires citizens on an individual daily basis finding that self-mastery to be more perfect. But they insist that the whole key to the success of the experiment is that kind of personal and political civic virtue. The Pursuit of Happiness book asks, how did the founders embody these virtues in their lives? They talked about it a lot, how'd they do? And of course, the best way to learn history is through storytelling, and it's so exciting and meaningful just to tell the stories of the founders and learn about their struggles. And what struck me so much is not that they were perfect, because they were, of course, far from perfect, because they were human, but how mindful they were about their own struggles to achieve perfection. They're talking constantly in their diaries and letters and conversations about their failures and the ways on a daily basis that they fell short, but always trying to do better. I start the discussion of John and Abigail Adams with their remarkable decision while they were dating to make a list of each other's faults. And I can report that this is not a great dating strategy. And they almost, stumbled over it, because John Adams is one of the most famously vain and self-regarding men of his age. He's obnoxious and disliked, as the musical 1776 says. He's always storming about the fact that he's not getting enough credit for the American Revolution, and, you know, he's not appreciated enough. But Abigail soft pedals this in making a list of his faults. She says, "You're so brilliant that some people might find you intellectually intimidating." And he counters with his typical tact, well, you should read more and play the piano more, plus you're pigeon-toed. So she, with great self-possession, replies, "I will try to practice and read more, but gentlemen should not comment on ladies' posture." Remember, they're getting all this from Pythagoras, because Adams has read Pythagoras's Golden Virtues, and so is Abigail, who's just as voracious a reader as he is, and they're making a list of each other's faults. So despite this beginning, they marry, they go on to have one of the most moving, intellectual, romantic, and meetings of the soul in American letters. And they take all of their emphasis on self-improvement and bring it to their son, John Quincy Adams. And if I had to pick a hero from the founding era, at least one, it has to be Quincy, because he's so mindful in trying to live the virtues. He's getting this constantly from his dad and especially his mom. I thought having a Jewish mom could be challenging and tough. At times, it turns out that having a Puritan mom is even harder, because she was never off of his case. She was constantly enjoining him to be more perfect, and she reads from the proverb. I was going to get the language exactly, because it's so striking, but it's the one that says that he who is slow to anger is greater than he who taketh a village. And that's from the Hebrew Proverbs, and she's applying the wisdom. And Quincy gets from this a constant sense that he's making a hash of it and falling short, and that he's not mastering his temper enough, and he's indolent, and he's not productive enough. There's this amazing passage in his diary. He's something like 32 years old. He's just turned down an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. He's minister to St. Petersburg, and he said, "If only I weren't so indolent, if I had more self-discipline, I might have ended war and slavery." He set a very high bar for himself. "But as it is, I'm, you know, wasting too much time at the theater, I'm drinking too much Madeira, I'm just making a total hash of it." He, of course, is the contrary. He's incredibly productive. He becomes a professor of classics at Harvard, where he teaches Cicero, in particular his favorite book, The Tusculan Disputations. He's elected president of the United States, and then he has two terrible blows that cut him to the quick. First, he loses re-election in 1828, and around the same time, his oldest son, George Washington Adams, commits suicide. It's an incredibly sad story. Imagine having the burden of being named George Washington Adams and all of the burdens of those expectations. And also, Adams was a very demanding father, and he wrote a series of letters from a Christian father to his son, which are very inspiring, learned parsings of the Proverbs and the Bible based on Adams' close reading, but it was just too much pressure to impose on a son, and George Washington Adams descends into alcoholism and then jumps off a steamship. And Adams doesn't know how he can continue. So he spends a year returning to the most profound texts he knows, Cicero and the Bible. And he reads them daily. And based on his close reading of the Bible, in particular, a passage where Jesus promises to free the captives, Adams resolves to become the most fervent white abolitionist of his time. He reaches a similar conclusion to the one that Joseph Smith reached when he read the scripture and concluded that it forbids slavery. And Vice President Collings gave me the passage from Joseph Smith. It's just amazing today. It was around the same time that he and Quincy Adams are concluding that the Bible forbids slavery. And Adams then goes and gets elected to the House of Representatives, the first president to return to the House. And he becomes a fervent abolitionist based on his scriptural reading. He denounces the gag rule, which forbids the reading of abolitionist petitions. He introduces a constitutional amendment to end slavery. He then votes against the Mexican War. He yells, "No!" And then he collapses in the House. He's carried to a sofa. And his last murmured words are, "I am composed." And he gets that from Cicero, from the Tusculan Disputations. Remember that passage Jefferson would hand out? The perfectly self-composed person is he who has achieved virtuous self-mastery. It's just this breathtaking, mindful, virtuous end to a virtuous life. And Adams got it from his deep reading and his study of the scripture. There's so much else to say about other founders and their own struggles to achieve self-mastery. I was very struck by the fact that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, when they are old, after they've written the Declaration together, fallen out over politics in the bloodiest battle in history, the Republic almost came apart in 1800, they reconcile. What do they want to talk about? Spiritual self-mastery. That's the topic that they're corresponding on when they're old. And Adams is so excited when he's learned that Pythagoras, the founder of Greek moral philosophy, may have traveled to the East and read the Hindu Vedas. And Adams is struck by the fact that the central lesson of the Vedas, renounce and enjoy, renounce attachment to external events and enjoy eternal salvation, is the same lesson as the Stoic dichotomy of control, which says don't focus on trying to control the thoughts and actions of others. Focus on the only thing you can control, which is your own thoughts and actions and self-mastery. And Adams thinks if it can just be shown that Pythagoras read the Gita, then it'll established that all the wisdom traditions of the East and the West are devoted to this same idea of spiritual self-mastery. The Dhammapada says we are what we think. Life is shaped by the mind. And Adam sums up this learning into his own mature creed, which he attributes to the hymn of Cleanth, love God and all his creatures, rejoice in all things. And Jefferson, after a lifetime of disciplined reading, concludes that he is no longer a Stoic, but an Epicurean. But he means by that not heedless pleasure-seeking or hedonism. That's a libel on Epicurus by the Stoics. For Jefferson, mindful Epicureanism requires the rational contraction of our desires so that we can mindfully meet them. It's just incredibly moving to see Adams and Jefferson really just leading such a morally serious life at that stage, and that's their conclusion. I do have to say a word about Jefferson and slavery. It was striking to see the degree of his hypocrisy. How is it possible that someone who exalted the virtues of frugality and self-mastery and also believed that slavery violated the Bible and natural law, not only continued to own slaves, but at his death only freed a handful, his own children, by Sally Hemings keeping a promise to her. I did find clarifying a quotation from Patrick Henry right after he had delivered the Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death oration. He said, "Is it not amazing that I myself, who believe that slavery violates the Bible and natural law, myself own slaves? I won't justify it. I won't attempt to. It's simple avarice or greed. I can't do with the inconvenience of living without it." And that brutal moment of candor, "I know that it's wicked and immoral and violates the Bible, but I like the lifestyle and don't want to give it up," was basically the same confession that Jefferson and the other enslavers of that generation made. They liked the lifestyle and didn't want to give it up, and it doesn't excuse their moral hypocrisy, but does help us realize that they were well aware of it. Contrast Jefferson with someone like George Washington, so self-mastered, he did free his slaves on his death, and his greatest moment is at Newburgh when the soldiers are about to rebel. He mounts the temple of virtue and appeals for prudence and self-mastery, and says, "If you can just wait a little longer, I'll ensure that you're paid. Don't engage in a military coup and crush the experiment at its core." He goes to read a letter from a friend and struggles to read it and puts on his reading glasses and says, "Forgive me, gentlemen, I've grown old in your service, and now I've grown almost blind." And the soldiers weep because they've never seen him express humility and weakness before. And that's that remarkable combination of self-mastery and humility that makes Washington the greatest man of his age. At the end of his life, Washington warns that the experiment will fail unless we, the people, find virtuous self-mastery and are able to find the political self-government necessary for personal self-government. He's not sure that the experiment will succeed, nor are Madison and Hamilton and the Constitution framers. It all depends on virtue. And Madison, in particular, is worried about the excesses of mob democracy. He says, "In all large assemblies of any character composed, passion never fails to wrest the scepter from reason. Even if every Athenian had been Socrates, Athens would still have been a mob." Madison is especially optimistic about a new media technology that allows broadside newspapers to be dispersed throughout the land, and is hopeful that citizens will read complicated arguments like the Federalist Papers in the newspaper, and based on their close reading, will slowly diffuse reason across the land, setting aside their partisan passions, listening to competing points of view, and guided by a new class of enlightened journalists and statesmen he calls the literati, reason will slowly diffuse across the land. Just to share this vision shows how far we are from that world. We live in an age of enrage to engage on social media, where posts based on passion travel further and faster than those based on reason, where all of us are amusing ourselves to death and retreating into our filter bubbles and echo chambers, are not listening to other points of view, are not respectfully deliberating, and in those ways are living in a version of Madison's nightmare. But I want to share with you as I close the big takeaways from my reading project and then an injunction for all of you. The takeaway was to get back into the habit of deep reading. I'd fallen out of the habit of reading for stuff that wasn't related to my deadlines. And because I'm just addicted to these screens and spending so much time on my phone. And that weird, clarifying, stretching, spiritually uplifting project of spending 2 hours every morning reading changed my habits. So I'm not catching the sunrise every morning, and I don't want to pretend that I'm a virtue monger, and I'm not reading moral philosophy for 2 hours every morning. But I do have a new rule that when I wake up, I am not allowed to browse or surf until I've read. I have to read for a half hour or an hour. And it's just changed my life. I've just finished a new book about how the battle between Hamilton and Jefferson has defined all of American history, and it allowed me to do that. And I just learned something new every day. So that's my injunction to you. Carve out time to read, and not just for your classes, but for your own elevation, for your self-improvement, for your spiritual and moral benefit. And it's just a habit like all those other habits of virtue, but it's completely great. And then the final thing I want you to do is continue to take advantage of the fact that you are blessed to be at this great university, which has put learning about the Constitution front and center. And your president is so visionary in making that one of the pillars of your education. And what I want to say is that you have a right, an opportunity, and even a duty to do it, unless you learn about the principles of the Constitution and the Declaration and the American idea, unless you understand how important it was for the framers to listen to different points of view, to disagree without being disagreeable, and to go deep on the principles that define this nation, then the Republic will fall. And my final injunction is from John Quincy Adams. I told you he was my hero. On the Jubilee of the Constitution, George Washington's 50th anniversary, 1839, Quincy fears civil war, and he says the only thing that will prevent civil war is learning about the principles of the Constitution and the Declaration. And then he quotes the book of Deuteronomy based on his close reading of the Bible. And he says, take these principles as frontlets between your eyes. Place them upon your doorposts, bind them to your hands and your arms, whisper them to your children before you sleep, make them the principles of your political salvation. That's how important it was for John Quincy Adams for us to learn the principles of the Declaration and the Constitution. I know you are going to do exactly that, and I thank you for the blessing of being able to talk to you today. Thank you so much.